It is a fact that Anchorage has been one of the most difficult communities for any of these businesses to get established.
The state gets new leadership for its blooming cannabis industry. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 21st. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, new research projects are starting at the old HARP facility.
This is a fantastic research facility. It is not capable of all the things that it's been accused of.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
There are three different proposals to draw money from Alaska permanent fund earnings to pay for part of the state government's budget. Permanent fund head Angela Rodell told the Senate Finance Committee today that fund officers don't take an opinion on what the draw should be, but
all of those different draw amounts, my only statement to them is that they're all reasonable draw amounts.
Governor Bill Walker proposes that the state draw 5.25% of fund earnings each year. The House Finance Committee proposes only 5%, and Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman's proposal knocks it down to 4.5%. While those numbers may sound familiar, the differences add up. Walker's bill would draw roughly $400 million more each year than Stedman's. Rodell adds that the state should have other sources of revenue as well.
We don't want to be in a position of being the only taxpayer, so to speak, the only funder of state government, because that is going to be a very uncomfortable place to be.
All of the bills require cutting the amount that Alaskans receive each year in permanent fund dividends. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says lawmakers are approaching the bills with reluctance.
I believe I'm saying safely that there isn't a single legislator that's currently elected or previously elected that would relish the idea of using the earnings reserves.
Hearings on all three bills are scheduled for this week. Northern Dynasty Minerals issued a response Friday to a New York hedge fund's claims that the Pebble project in Bristol Bay is overhyped and overvalued. That report drove the Vancouver-based mineral exploration company's share prices to tumble quickly, but Northern Dynasty officials say they are the target of an aggressive activist short-selling attempt based on unsupported speculation. KDLG's Dave Benninger reports.
In a lengthy press release, Northern Dynasty Minerals refutes the 20-page Carisdale report point by point, mainly referring to the hedge fund derisively as short-seller. That Carisdale Capital specializes in activist short selling is something it openly acknowledges, saying in an interview last week that they seek out companies they believe are publicly trading too high, loudly call attention to them, and profit when the stock value drops. That's the main point Northern calls attention to, but also takes issue with Carisdale's reliance on, quote, anonymous co-authors whose mining credentials, if any, were not disclosed. Northern goes on to say Carisdale never requested or had access to the company's technical or analytical reports, executives or experts, and questions what, if anything, they know about the mining industry. Carisdale claimed that the Pebble deposit contains low-grade ore that will not prove profitable to extract. Northern says Pebble ranks in the top fourth of major producing and non-producing deposits in the world. Northern goes on to lay out the merits of Pebble, saying it is one of the largest gold and copper resources on the planet and will not be as technically challenging to engineer as Carisdale suggested. Northern Dynasty says it is preparing a comprehensive strategy, including possible changes in project design, to advance the Pebble project with public consensus into permitting. The company added that it would take any action necessary against Carisdale Capital to protect the interest of its shareholders. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The Alaska State Medical Board has proposed new abortion regulations. The proposals were prompted by a lawsuit from abortion rights advocates who argue that existing rules restrict second trimester abortions. Deborah Stovern, the board's executive administrator, says the lawsuit called attention to the age of the existing rules. She says some are more than 30 years old and perhaps due for review. The proposed new rules, among other things, would repeal a requirement that a physician consult with another doctor before performing an abortion after the 12th week of gestation. The lawsuit from Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands is on hold to give the board more time to consider its rules. Planned Parenthood's Katie Rogers says her organization won't make final decisions about the case until any rule changes are final. The state announced today a new head for the office in charge of regulating alcohol and marijuana. Erica McConnell has worked in Anchorage's municipal planning department for more than a decade. More recently, she wrote the city's regulations for commercial cannabis businesses. McConnell's new job as director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office falls under the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Commissioner Chris Laddick says her expertise on local regulation makes McConnell an asset for state administration.
She's well positioned to take on management and regulatory duties of this position. She was the marijuana coordinator while for the city, and I think that speeds up her onboarding process as she learns, you know, the state's regulatory structure.
The AMCO director has a lot of influence in shaping the state government's role in Alaska's new cannabis industry. In the months ahead, McConnell will have a say in controversial issues like on-site consumption and the legality of certain concentrated oils. Shortly after news of the appointment today, opinions from industry members were mixed. Bruce Schulte is the former chair of the Marijuana Control Board and has reservations over whether McConnell's background will align with industry needs.
It is a fact that Anchorage has been one of the most difficult communities, really the most difficult community for any of these businesses to get established. And Erica's been very key in that process. So, you know, I hope that we don't see any more complication extend statewide like what we've seen in Anchorage.
Schulte says he hopes that McConnell will bring a broader perspective to the office, which he's criticized for being too top-down in the rulemaking process.
I would hope that we'd see a friendlier interaction with the cannabis industry and an AMCO office that's there to help them succeed rather than throw yet more obstacles in their way.
Others found the appointment more encouraging. Attorney Jenna Weltzien represents several cannabis businesses in Alaska and says she's found McConnell to be tough but fair. Weltzien added, quote, "She's going to be hard on both sides, which is how it should be." McConnell takes over as AMCO director on March 30th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the gritty realism of being a writer in Alaska and why locals are so hard to please.
Alaska is some of the best readers, I would argue, in the country and probably the world.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Join Alaskan leaders for an online discussion about civility in the last frontier Thursday, February 23rd from 5:30 to 7 at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan is urging the State Board of Game to get behind legislation to repeal a rule regulating predator control on federal wildlife refuges in Alaska. Sullivan is sponsoring a resolution of disapproval, similar to the one passed by the U.S. House. It would turn back the Obama-era rule that specifically bans some bear, wolf, and coyote killing techniques, including certain aircraft, trap, and bait-assisted harvests. Senator Sullivan addressed the Game Board during their meeting in Fairbanks today, telling members he needs their help fighting repeal opponents who he says are mischaracterizing state wildlife management.
They're going to show, you know, wolf puppies and leg traps, and they're going to make this about cruelty. And what we need to be able to do is talk about the science and the biology and your record and our state's record as being able to do this better than anybody, certainly better than the feds.
The game board was receptive to Sullivan's request for support. Board Chair Ted Spraker says the federal government stands in the way of the board taking action that could help feed more Alaskans.
You know, we're tasked with food security. We have a subsistence law in our state. There are a lot of places in our state with just a little bit of active management. We could turn some of these declining populations around.
The state has authority to manage its wildlife, but federal agencies are mandated to maintain natural diversity. Sullivan says he's reached out to U.S. senators from other states for support, trying and explaining that the Alaska predator harvest rule is a state's rights issue.
It's an Alaska-only rule, but it'll have important precedential implications if it stays on the books for all your states.
The state of Alaska is already suing the federal government to turn back Alaska predator harvest rules issued by the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service. Sullivan cautions that the case could take years. The resolution targeting Fish and Wildlife Service rule employs the Congressional Review Act, a time-limited revocation option, and is not applicable to National Park Service predator rule. About 200 paratroopers from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson dropped into Dead Horse today as part of a Joint Army-Air Force rapid deployment exercise. It also includes Stryker Brigade soldiers and equipment from Fort Wainwright. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports on the plans for the three-day excursion.
The exercise is called Spartan Pegasus, and it's intended to demonstrate the ability of paratroopers and Strykers to deploy quickly to and operate in the Arctic.
It's all about demonstrating this capability to move and not just survive executing an airborne operation in the Arctic or high-altitude environment, but really thrive in the extreme cold.
Lieutenant Colonel Ethan Diven commands the Army's 1st Squadron 40th Cavalry Regiment Airborne out of J-Bear. That'll be sending the paratroopers to Dead Horse. He says the exercise is the third in a series conducted over the past 14 months, and he says this one calls for a more rapid deployment using Air Force transports and Chinook helicopters out of Wainwright.
The paratroopers and heavy equipment will move in aircraft, both C-130 and C-17, from J-Bear. And then the Strykers that are up at Wainwright will move via some C-17s and make their way out to Dead Horse. And then the CH-47s, the Chinooks, will fly from Fort Wainwright.
The units will all converge at the site 500 miles north of Fairbanks, where they'll carry out what Diven describes as an unusual mission, that is, recovering a downed satellite.
We are going to conduct that airborne insertion with the closest unit, and it's the fastest way to get us there to secure it and then recover it.
Diven says that part of the exercise is a bit out of the ordinary because it calls for the military to respond to a request from a civilian federal agency. A U.S. Army Alaska spokesman says the scenario doesn't identify what kind of satellite would be recovered. Diven says the Army uses Dead Horse for the training because it's north of the Arctic Circle and is consistently cold enough to test soldiers and equipment. The exercise is scheduled to wrap up on Thursday. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska became the third state in the nation to legalize recreational marijuana in 2015, but it's not exactly ahead of the curve on hemp, which comes from the same plant. Now, with growing pressure to diversify Alaska's economy, lawmakers are talking about legalizing hemp for commercial purposes, something at least 30 other states have already done. KTOO's Caroline Halter reports.
Jack Bennett is a home builder in Homer, Alaska. For the last year, he's been working on a model home that he sees as a potential solution to affordable housing and energy in rural parts of the state. He's using materials made from hemp.
We acquired a facility for the year, imported the hemp insulation material, and started to run experiments with it to build a brick tailored for cold climate Alaska.
There's just one problem. It's illegal to grow hemp in Alaska. So Bennett imports his product from the Netherlands. The 2014 Federal Farm Bill allows states to grow and harvest hemp through pilot programs. Senator Shelley Hughes is sponsoring legislation that would establish such a program in Alaska.
I think this is one more economic opportunity for farmers and Alaskans that it's due time.
But moving forward with the program is not as simple as waving a wand and making hemp legal. Lawmakers have to decide on a regulatory framework that complies with federal regulations without stifling the industry before it even takes off. In a hearing on February 13th, Senator Bill Willikowski commented on Hughes' legislation.
It's requiring that individuals register, requiring that they list their global positioning coordinates. They've got to register every year. They've got to pay fees for applications, and the fees have to cover the regulatory costs. So this is big government. I mean, this is extremely onerous.
Don Hart, a farmer in the Mat-Su Valley, is also concerned about overregulating the new industry.
In order to benefit the farmers in the state of Alaska, it would be better to be able to remove it entirely from AS 1738.
Alaska Statute 1738, the statute that Hart referred to, lumps marijuana and hemp together under the same definition, allowing for local control over where the plant can be grown.
It allows anyone who does not want to see hemp growing in Alaska to be able to raise the issue by initiative or to propose their borough or the administrative or the municipalities to be able to exclude it.
Alaska cultivated hemp until it's banned in 1937 under the Federal Marijuana Tax Act. Bennett, the home builder from Homer, says that the plant did well in Alaska, where it's not always easy to grow things. He's committed to helping the industry grow.
Alaska is said to be in a fiscal crisis. It's a positive. It's our opportunity. It's our generation that gets to fix it. And hemp might not be the solution, but it's a solution. Give them the freedom to farm, and let's find out.
The legislation will go to the Senate Judiciary Committee next, pending referral from Senate Resources. In Juneau, I'm Caroline Halter.
After an expedited review, a referendum on Anchorage's new taxicab regulation will be on the April ballot. The ballot question asks voters if they want to repeal an ordinance that passed last December, creating more than 100 additional taxi permits in the municipality over the next 5 years. Sponsors said the measure aims to foster competition in the industry. The ordinance also allows medical vehicles for hire to take Medicaid vouchers and creates a new kind of taxi permit for nonprofits that serve people with disabilities. The ordinance was fiercely opposed by cab drivers and the taxi industry. Drivers say they're already struggling to make a living with the current number of cabs on the road, and that adding more permits unfairly dilutes the money invested under the capped system. To be on the ballot, referendum sponsors gathered nearly 6,000 voter signatures. The clerk's office received the petition last Friday. Deputy Clerk Amanda Mosier says it took 12 people 9 hours to review all the signatures and ensure that it could be included on the April 4th ballot. Otherwise, the city would have had to call a special election, which cost about $400,000.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. If you're looking for ways to enhance your business knowledge about government contracting, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center statewide annual conference in Anchorage on March 8th. The PTAC conference presents a day of general sessions, learning labs, networking, and the popular Perfect Pitch competition. There will also be an opportunity to interact with representatives from government agencies. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
A new University of Alaska report finds that the majority of Alaska high school graduates attending UA schools are not prepared for entry-level courses in math and English. The research was completed by UAA's Alaska Native Science and Engineering program. It shows that from 2006 to 2015, nearly 61% of college freshmen coming from Alaska's 37 largest high schools required some amount of remedial coursework. Students from the five schools with the highest percentages of graduates requiring remedial coursework had an average GPA of an A-. Dr. Herb Schroeder with ANSEP says the data does not point to any sort of urban-rural divide in terms of college readiness.
There are clearly systemic issues that reach down in the entire K-12 system. And we're not interested in pointing any fingers. What we want to do is raise awareness about the issue, and we want to work to align the curriculum between K-12 and the university.
The heads of the state's K-12 public school system and the University of Alaska system have begun working on aligning curriculum and are coming up with long-term goals on how to make Alaska high school graduates more prepared for college. Experiments are scheduled through the end of the month at the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HARP, facility. It's the first time science is being conducted at the Ionospheric Research Station at Gokana since the University of Alaska Fairbanks took it over from the Air Force in 2015. UAF Geophysical Institute has spent the last 2 years overhauling generators, antenna, and other equipment that's used to simulate the electrically charged area of the upper atmosphere. GI spokesperson Sue Mitchell highlights two of the projects that are part of the upcoming federally funded research campaign at HARP.
One of the projects will create an artificial aurora. It will not be visible by the naked eye, but should be able to pick it up with cameras. And then they're testing the feasibility of using HARP to do some over-the-horizon radar applications. Take a look at the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean, perhaps by bouncing transmissions off of the ionosphere.
Mitchell says HARP is being operated on a pay-as-you-go basis, similar to the Poker Flat rocket launch facility it runs for NASA. She says HARP is expected to be online for less than a day during the first run of projects because it's so costly to operate.
The rate for running HARP runs about $5,000 an hour. The generators are very expensive. They take a lot of fuel to run per hour, so that's the main cost.
The generators energize HARP's 3.6-megawatt transmitter, beaming signals through 180 antenna into the ionosphere, 50 to 600 miles above the Earth's surface. Mitchell says the public can track what's going on at HARP's through HARP's Facebook page. It's part of an effort to debunk lingering conspiracy theories about what happens at the former military research facility. Those theories include weather and mind control.
A fantastic research facility. It is not capable of all the things that it's been accused of, but it is a really fascinating and interesting and powerful research tool.
Agencies funding this month's HARP research projects include the National Science Foundation, the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and the Naval Research Laboratory. UAF-based researchers are involved in the projects. Constructing and maintaining buildings in rural Alaska can be hard. There aren't enough people in rural communities who know how to fix things like sheet metal roofing, and it's expensive to send out contractors, especially for smaller jobs. Now, a new partnership of urban trainers and rural workers is seeing if it can take what's taught in urban Alaska and create an apprenticeship program for rural communities. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Bruce Bold coordinates the Sheet Metal Workers Union's Local 23 apprenticeship program in Anchorage. Last winter, he was at a conference when he struck up a conversation with a lady from rural Alaska.
And, you know, she was talking about some of the issues in rural Alaska that they're running into. A lot of it was maintenance type issues on maintaining equipment.
And Bold thought, hey, we offer that training. How can we get it to rural Alaska? Then he started talking with contractors about how they'd like to be able to hire locally in rural areas.
They're like, wow, if I had someone local I could, you know, put onto a job instead of flying a guy out there, paying him per diem, you know, paying for his plane ticket, especially for a small little job.
Some contractors, he found out, won't bid on certain rural jobs because they can't find qualified local workers. With that, Bold reached out to Bob Marquez, who runs the mechanic and welder program for the Coastal Villages Region Fund. CVRF is part of Alaska's Groundfish Community Development Quota Program and is tasked with economically developing the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta's coastal communities. Bold knew there was a need for rural Alaska training, but he didn't know what that training needed to be. Marquez agreed to send a group of CVRF mechanics and welders to Anchorage for 3 days to help him figure that out.
They're learning what our needs are and what's valuable for education and training, and we're learning from them. So this really is a test. We want to see how it benefits our employees, and furthermore, how it will benefit the residents of the communities.
The hope is to shape an apprenticeship sheet metal and service technician program for rural Alaska. More contractors could then hire locally in rural areas. Bold says everything is in the preliminary stages, but the program could begin as a pilot project with CVRF. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Sitka author Brendan Jones has won a statewide award for his book, The Alaskan Laundry. KCAW's Emily Kwong spoke with Jones about the honor and gritty realism of Alaskan writing.
The Alaskana Award was created in 1994 to recognize one work of fiction or nonfiction that, quote, gives significant contributions to the understanding of Alaska, exhibiting originality, depth of research, and knowledge. But the best part for Brendan Jones, the winner this year, is that the Alaskana Award is decided by librarians around the state.
But they were the ones who, nominated and recognized this book. Just warms my heart.
While The Alaskan Laundry is fictional, there are strands of memoir. The protagonist, an Italian-American woman named Tara Marconi, was raised in Philadelphia. Jones was too. She lands a job at a salmon hatchery in Port Anna, a community much like Sitka, and settles into a life much like Jones's, commercial fishing and refurbishing a World War II-era tugboat. Since its publication last year, the 380-page paperback was a pick of the month for Oprah's book club and longlisted for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize. But for Jones, the national awards pale in comparison to a statewide nod.
Alaska is some of the best readers, I would argue, in the country and probably the world as a result of our winters and small communities. And even the fishing community, I mean, some of the best readers are trollers because, if the story doesn't catch their attention very quickly, they're going to put it down. So they're very discriminating in a way. The literati in New York City or what have you, San Francisco, is not. So ringing bell with those folks, I think it's just... it's just the best and definitely what I was hoping to do.
Previous recipients of the Alaskana Award include Nora and Richard Dauenauer and Lydia Black for Russians in Tlingit America, The Battles of Sitka, and Heather Lendy for If You Lived Here, I'd Know Your Name. Last year, at the Association of Writers and Writing Programs in Seattle, attendees were asking themselves, are we in the middle of an Alaskan literary renaissance? Jones thinks so, for the same reason there's been a boom in reality television based in Alaska. Jones, who started Alaskan Laundry 11 years ago, describes his writing style as dirt and grit realism. He's inspired by authors like Raymond Carver, Tobias Wolff, and Richard Ford.
Writing kind of short declarative sentences that, to use a familiar phrase, just kind of shows things or describes things as they are.
Jones will receive his award at the Alaska Library Association's annual conference on February 25th in Ketchikan. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Caroline Halter in Juneau, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Tim Bodoni in Galena, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Mr. Eric Bork. Ann Hillman edited and produced tonight's show. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska.
The Bristol Bay Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Naknek February 28th and March 1st at Dolly's Hall from 8:30 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.